What's up, War Stories fans? I want to talk to you about Ocker Leather Duty Gear for a minute. When performance is your number one priority, we all know choosing the right gear for the job is crucial to your mission success. I used Ocker Leather Duty Gear almost exclusively. If they made it, that's what I used. Ocker Leather Duty Gear gives you the confidence to perform at the highest level in the field, day in and day out. With over 40 years of experience crafting high-quality products for the law enforcement community, Ocker Leather specializes in making holsters, belts, and all the other accessories, and they stand the test of time. Let me tell you, I still have all my Ocker Duty gear, and it is well worn in, but still as nice as the day I got it. Major municipal and federal agencies from LAPD and Border Patrol trust Ocker to outfit their officers with duty gear that wears in and not out. And it's made in America since 1981, so that is awesome. Ocker is renowned for being the best name in leather, so visit OckerLeather.com and use the coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order. That's Adam, King, Edward, Robert, Lincoln, Edward, Adam, Tom, Henry, Edward, Robert.com and use coupon code WARSTORIES for 10% off your order.
Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Chuck.
And we are back for another episode of this podcast for you. And it's been an interesting couple of weeks for us. We're going to do this on the front end. Chuck's got some cool designs I saw you're working on for a new patch idea. And the t-shirts are coming along nicely.
Yeah. So I'm going to be... I've contacted Watch 3 Apparel. Should be teaming up with them to do a shirt, which will just be our stuff. They just do some screen printing for us. They're going to do some screen printing for us. So it'd be really cool to collaborate with someone who's out here, you know, who's another copper to help out, you know, another police-owned business. But also, yeah, I've been working on a patch. Patch guy reached out to us. And then I know a lot of you guys want like the FAFO, fuck around and find out. You know, I've been tagging that a lot in some of the Instagram stuff. So we've decided to work on a patch. Yeah. But not going to tell you what it is because you got
to
wait.
No, you got to wait to see it. And then also I did some digging and we had talked about a possibly knowing a cop that was involved in a caper that's on Netflix right now. And I determined that we do not know a cop that was involved in that caper. I spoke to a friend of the podcast who you guys might remember, Salty Operator, Elliot. John's dad, and Elliot was a canine officer for those of you who've listened to the show for LAPD, and he was there around that time, but apparently they were not working with the Bloodhounds yet, and so it would have been Metro that had probably come out and quote fucked up that dog track.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, so yeah, my dad was in Metro back in the day, and I always joke with him that when he was working Metro, he was part of the beat and release program.
Oh yeah. You know, I've heard a lot of their training with their dogs, though. They do it with electrostimulation. And then when the other handlers that, you know, maybe have a better track record, they don't necessarily use electrostimulation shock collars.
Yeah. I've worked with handlers and none of them have ever used the shock collars. None of them.
Yeah, I've worked with some handlers, and that's their like go-to. They zap the shit out of their dog.
Yeah, but those are like vicious land sharks that have to go back in the box whenever they're not working.
Right. Those are high-strung Malinois.
Titanium teeth and just freaking oof. Anyway, yeah. But you have a setup for something interesting today. Why don't you tell everybody about it?
Yeah, so we have Ryan here. He reached out to us via the email for the podcast, and he was interested in coming on the show. He's a firefighter, and he recently had a pretty gnarly call that he wants to talk about, and you know, with some experience. And without further ado, Ryan, introduce yourself, bud.
So I'm Ryan. I come from a minor city in the state of Pennsylvania. I run with a combination department, so we have a couple career guys, mostly volunteers, and I've been, you know, volunteering for a little over 2 years.
Okay, so awesome. You're a volunteer firefighter with a small municipal Pennsylvania fire department.
Yes.
Okay. And you've been doing that for 2 years?
Yeah, just a little over 2 years.
Now, how do they work it over in your area as far as training? Do you have to go to a full fire academy? Is it a reserve academy? Is it a volunteer academy? Is it OJT?
They just send us to, I went to the local county's fire academy to go through my Fire One course. I was not allowed to go inside any buildings until I had my certification. Once I had that, then I was allowed to go in and do what I need to do.
So you signed up and then they put you through the academy, is that correct?
Yes, they paid for all the classes and everything.
Is that full time or is that a full time
academy? It was part time. I did it over, well, with COVID and everything, about a year and a half.
Okay. So this is new to you. You're fresh to this whole thing. How are you enjoying it so far?
There's not a time that I wouldn't want to go on a call. You know, I really enjoy it. You know, it's part of my daily life when I'm not working. So
nice.
So you had reached out to Chuck and tell us about that for a second, because we get listeners occasionally that'll reach out to us, and we've had them on before to share stories. How did you find us, and how did you end up reaching out to Chuck?
So I found your podcast. I was just looking through Spotify, you know, trying to find some kind of first responder, you know, something to listen to, hear stories. And you guys popped up, you know, I started listening. I liked your content. Not sure when I started listening. I think it was around, you know, episode 30, you know, went back, watched everything, you know, and I continue watching to this day. You know, just finally had a good story that I wanted to share.
Well, the floor is yours, man. What is your story?
So we had a call probably about a month ago, back in June, where it came in as a building fire. Police called it in with fire in the back windows, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. Or, I'm sorry, about 2:30 in the morning. So, you know, as our area does, mostly it's the career guys take the trucks immediately and, you know, go to the call, and then the volunteers just go right to the scene. We don't have to hop on the trucks or anything. So, you know, I drive myself direct to the call.
In your personal car?
You keep all, yes. So this is how I can say from experience in our city, we had a full-time fire department, but we also had the volunteer fire department, which was pretty much the only way to get into like the firefighting system locally, was to have volunteered somewhere. And these guys, man, when they call out, these guys roll from home with their turnouts and their freaking pickup trucks, and they jump out. Yeah. You roll up to the fire, pull all their gear out of their pickup truck, get ready on scene, and then join the full-time guys. And they have to be like ready to go whenever they get to, you know, get the call. Holy and shit. That's it.
That's crazy.
Is that about right for you, Ryan?
Yeah. Yeah, usually if I'm in the area, you know, I'll drive right to the scene, you know, get my gear on and go to work.
Wow. Yeah, it's like, you know, being constantly on call. And do you get paid per incident that you respond to, or is it completely volunteer, completely free?
For our area, it's completely free. There are, you know, other departments in the area that do have their stipend programs. But since we run, you know, combination, there's no money for us to earn in that.
So that's just true dedication.
Yeah, because there's no way I would be like a volunteer police officer for free anywhere. There's no way.
No. Just,
like, not going to happen.
No. Wow, that's crazy. I mean, yeah. So you basically, you have all the training, you have all your stuff, you're ready to go run into a burning building and try to save some people's lives, yet you're not going to get paid for it, and yet you're still going to go ahead and do it.
Yep.
Absolutely. It's,
because it's, you know, the right thing to do.
Yep. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's 2:30 in the morning and you're rolling out there in your POV.
Yeah. So we're told to park at least a block away, you know, stay out of the way of the trucks and everything. And having the call come in from the police, you know, it's usually a fire when they call it in.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just someone kind of freaking out that, you know, the pot of food is smoking or something. So, you know, we have fire not out of the windows yet, but, you know, you can definitely see the glow inside. So, you know, they pull up, they give their report and everything, and I get there, you know, I run up to the truck, I grab a pack, and I go up to command, I ask them, what do you need from me? So they send me up to the porch roof, and, you know, go vent the bedroom windows. So, you know, I go up there. As soon as I break the one window, I realize it's a hoarding conditions inside. You know, ooh. I get a pile of clothes pulling out. You know, I realize there's no way to get in this window. So, you know, I yell down the command, let them know we have hoarding conditions. And at this point, they have a crew inside. You know, they got a hose line going. You know, they're doing some searches. And there's reports of nobody inside. You know, they say no one's home. You know, the neighbors are saying that. So we're not expecting to find anybody inside. So I continue to vent the windows. I, you know, pull the air conditioner out of the other one, clean up, and, you know, I yell down, hey, what do you want me to do? They said, come on down, we'll give you something else to do here. So at about that time, I'm seeing them bring the first victim out. You know, they're carrying her out while I'm standing right above them. You know, they put her on the stretcher and take her away. So that's when I realized, oh, we have people inside. You know, now this actually means a lot more.
So right, it's a whole different story once you know it's not just stuff.
It's no longer a controlled burn. It's, we have to try to get in there, get them out, and then put this thing out and try to vent it as best as we can.
Yeah. And from what they were saying inside was when I vented the windows, it was a huge relief and perfect timing for them. When they got upstairs, they were hit by, you know, very high heat, and it was almost too much that they had to back out. So, you know, when I vented those windows, they heard the glass break and immediately they felt the temperature drop. So it was very beneficial, crazy, you know, for them inside.
For free, by the way, Chuck, for free.
For free. That's in
for free.
Kids listening to this, people listening to this, adults, everyone. He's doing this for free.
And there's tons of volunteer firefighters just like him nationwide. Anyway, go ahead.
So, I'm sorry, I just kind of lost my train of thought there.
Temperature went down when you ventilated the windows.
Yeah, so that's what they were telling me, you know, after the fact.
We've done this a couple times.
They actually have a couple of, I guess someone was taking photographs during all this, and I made the page of the, you know, the local newspaper of me up on the roof vending the windows. So that was pretty cool to see that. So I come down, and it was a twin house. So they send me and another gentleman into the exposure house to go, you know, do a secondary search and go shut off the utilities, you know, find the gas meter, find the electric, and get that shut off. So we go in, you know, first floor is not too bad. It's pretty, you know, we have to mask up, but it's not terrible, you know, zero visibility. So we go in, you know, do our search. Everything's clear. We go down to the basement, no visibility whatsoever. It's just, you know, light smoke. It's nothing too terrible, but, you know, I can't see my hand in front of my face. And similar conditions to the other side, you know, somewhat hoarding conditions. So we're feeling our way. We can't find anything. You know, we looked on all the walls. We can't find the breaker panel. So I work in construction as my day job. So I took that knowledge and I found the dryer. And I knew that the wire from the dryer would lead right back to the panel. So I followed that, you know, felt along the ceiling and I found the panel. We got it shut off and then went back outside. I went through my first cylinder at that point, you know, I had to swap out, took a little break, and, you know, after about half an hour, you know, they had the fire out. They ended up bringing another victim out. And then, you know, we went back in to do a little bit of overhaul, you know, pull some ceiling, go check, you know, just make sure everything's cleaned up in there. So we go back in and they have us go up to the second floor. Cause now we're getting reports that there's a kid inside, you know, that there's a kid missing. You know, they're both the parents are out, but they have no, the kid's not accounted for. We don't know where he is. So, you know, we have to go through this hoarding condition and try to find this kid. So we go upstairs. The one back bedroom had about 3 feet of just clothes and toys inside of it. We basically had to dig a path through that room, you know, to check. And as we're doing that, we're also checking for extension. You know, I was carrying the tick and I had found a little bit of heat inside of one of the walls. So we cleared all this stuff away from it, started poking a couple holes and had some pretty heavy black smoke still coming out of it. So we stopped, you know, masked up and waited for a hose line to get up there. At the same time, they went to the back and started opening the roof up a little bit to see if there was any fire in there. And, you know, they hit it from there and the temperature went down a little bit.
So conditions are at least improving at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we're
still inside of a burning building, but
yeah, we didn't have any masks on at this point. The smoke was dissipated. You know, we were just, you know, finishing up.
Now you have a missing kid, and then you said you had a by your verbiage. I don't want to assume, but you say victim instead of patient. So I'm assuming the first person brought out of the house was a fatality.
Yes, actually, both of them ended up being. They were both. You know, they both passed. When they had been brought out, they were both brought back to life. The second victim was taken to the hospital and brought back, you know, there. And then shortly later, he passed away.
Holy crap.
And then the first victim had actually survived later into the day until that evening and then passed away in the hospital as well.
From smoke inhalation? Smoke inhalation or are they crispy critters?
It was from smoke inhalation. No fire had actually reached the second floor from where they were. It was all, you know, first floor fire and, you know, all the heat and smoke. You know, I don't want to like try to figure out what happened, but it looks like she opened the bedroom door and just face planted right there.
Ooh.
You know, smoke the heat and just
smoke and steered now, the lungs or whatever.
Ryan, when you're in there with your mask off, doing the overhaul, checking for any hotspots or stuff like that in the walls and stuff. I've been in a burning building. I've had a building set on fire around me in a police incident, and it was an active incident. So we had to wait outside. Fire hits it. We go back in and it was hot. Flames were out, but it was, man, it did not feel good on my skin. For other people that are listening, can you describe that heat when you walked into there, even though the fire's out,
smoke's dissipated,
what was that heat like still?
So these houses are mainly made of brick in that part of the town. So it holds the heat in really well. So like even, you know, hours after the fire, it's still, you know, a good temperature inside. The best I can relate to it is like sitting inside of a sauna, you know, with full turnout gear on. You know, you're essentially sweating the second you step in there already. And it was warm out. It was probably about 75, you know, in the middle of the night. So, you know, it was already warm. You know, they were, when I vented the window on the roof, it actually, you know, went right through my gear, right through my mask. And, you know, I felt it immediately. Wow. So I could only imagine what it was, you know, inside like that. But probably, you know, it was like sitting inside a sauna, you know, when we went back in. And this was, you know, about an hour after the call came in. So, you know, it's still pretty hot there.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I've also working fires, like that smell that gets in your uniform and gets in your nostrils and stuff, it just sticks with you. So to this day, if I'm like by a campfire and it starts to permeate my clothes, I have to take them off and take a shower. I just can't stand the smell of being covered in fire from having been on fire calls with firefighters and smelling like burnt house and person.
Yeah, I've had it, you know, the odor, it follows you everywhere. And no matter how many times you get your gear washed, you know, there's still remnants of it.
Yeah, it's so in your, it's like it's in everything. It just changes on a molecular level. You can't get it out of your nose for a week.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that I talk to don't know the difference between like a campfire and a house fire smell. So when they're smelling the smoke, you know, they think a house is on fire, but it's just someone in their backyard. Right. So having experienced what a house, you know, all those plastics and stuff like that is the burn. It's a completely different smell and, you know, nothing.
The word I use is acrid. It's just this, if smoke could be acidic.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
even
a good way to describe it.
Right. Walking in after the fact that it's just, you know, the smell of charred wood and plastic.
Yeah. Like a car fire, house fire, you know, structure fire, whatever, or a person fire. Like you could tell the difference when you start to smell people burning as opposed to just, you know, construction. And it's not like a campfire. It's similar, but there's just another level to it that's just toxic and gross.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot harder to breathe that kind of smoke than a campfire. So it's
if you think a campfire is bad, stand by.
So you know, we keep searching. We go through the kids' room. You know, we search under the bed. Nothing. We're moving piles of clothes, and we got nothing. So. They're finishing that. I go into the front bedroom with one of the other guys, and that's the room that I vented the windows in. So I see the pile of clothes up to the window. You know, I walk around the bed, you know, just looking. And at this point, it got a little bit lighter out, so we could kind of see. You know, I get down on my hands and knees, and I shine my light under the bed. You know, I got nothing. I let him know, you know, this room's good. Let's keep moving. So we head up to the third floor. Which is kind of like an attic space, but it was for storage, you know, completely covered in stuff. So we're flipping things over. We're looking under everything, you know, just can't find this kid anywhere. So it was a kitchen fire that had kind of spread into the dining room. So, you know, we had come back out and we were kind of, you know, chit-chatting a little bit. And our theory was the kid was making something, you know, on the stove. It caught fire. He ran out the back door and he's at some friend's house. You know, that's kind of what our theory was. So multiple people had, you know, probably about 10 people had searched the room that they had actually found him in, including myself. So, you know, about an hour later, you know, they're just doing their investigation and everything. And they take the fire marshals in. Well, they take them upstairs. And just at the right angle with the right lighting, they just catch a glimpse of probably about from his kneecap down about 6 inches. They could see just covered in soot, what looks like a leg. So, you know, he just happened to catch it at the right angle. And, you know, he said, I think that's the kid right there. And they moved the clothes out of the way. He was buried about a foot under a pile of clothes. And, you know, there he was. So then
he was trying to shield himself from the heat.
So the father was actually laying on top of the kid. That's where he was found.
Wow.
So
wow.
I think the father was trying to shield, you know, the kid. And they were both under that window that had the air conditioner in it. So one of the windows that I vented and pulled the air conditioner out of, they were right under that window. So if I had pushed it inside the house, it would have fell right on top of it. But the dad did have a little bit of burning on his back, you know, from the heat. But he was also laying up a little higher than everybody else was.
Right.
So, you know, he didn't make it very long at all. And the kid was, you know, I don't know what got him exactly, if it was the smoke or just, you know, being smothered or what, but he wasn't found until about, you know, 4 hours after the fire.
Man.
So, wow. You know, then we have to call in the coroner and they come in, you know, do their thing. And I wasn't in the room when they were moving him, but I was outside on the porch helping, you know, transfer him down the steps. So, you know, to be in that same room that he was in, I must have stepped right over top of him or, you know, maybe stepped on him, searched that room, said it was clear. And now I'm helping move this kid out. You know, house.
That must be tough.
Right. And you're a pretty young kid. You're fresh out of the academy. Is this your first fatal incident? Is this your first fatality, or is this how are you dealing with it, like, experience wise at this point in your career?
Technically, it was not my first fatal fire. My first one was a guy who had stolen a car, come back to the house, barricaded inside, and ended up shooting himself after he started a fire. So technically, no, but that was, you know, self-inflicted. He did that to himself.
Right.
You know, the first victim of a fire instead of being an asshole who decides to set his own house on fire, which, you know, let's face it. If you're on that one, you're like, well, let's just wait till it burns out.
That was, you know, not anything like this one. This would be, you know, I consider this my first, like, fatal fire.
Right. Because these people were victims, genuine victims of a fire in their home.
They didn't deserve this at all. You know, they were, from what I hear, a great family. I haven't gotten an exact age on the kid. He was between 12 and 14. So, you know, younger. Apparently he was a very good baseball player.
Yeah.
You know, all-star. Just an all-around, you know, nice family. Just terrible conditions.
Wow, that's sad.
Yeah.
So
that's terrible.
How is this, like, I'm assuming it's probably changed you in some way, maybe changed your life. How are you coping with that, and has it affected you in any way, or is it, you know, are you unaffected by it, or are you affected by it?
I'm usually the type of person that's not affected by a lot of things. So, you know, it was definitely not a good feeling to hear that they had found him in the room I was in. So they had actually called in a support team, you know, for our county to come in and do a little briefing with us, you know, kind of go over the incident and what happened and everything like that. So, you know, we went home and everything, and then we went to this meeting a little bit later in the day. This was a Monday, so I had called out of work. You know, I told my boss, hey, I'm not coming in. You know, this happened. So I went to that meeting. It was, you know, four guys from the county came in, and they were talking with us about it. And the kind of general consensus was everything we did operational was, you know, 100% perfect. You know, we could not have had a smoother operation in that sense. You know, the house did not.
In other words, you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't make mistakes that, you know, may have caused, you know, issues and stuff like that.
No, we narrowed it down to, you know, hoarding conditions. You know, it's what you're going to get. You can't, you know, search through everything in that house and, you know, find someone alive in there. So, what they kind of broke it down was, we gave those two people a chance to live is what we did. You know, if we did not pull them out when we did, they would have had zero chance of survival. Whereas, you know, they got them out, they were brought back to life, and they just didn't make it after that. So, you know, they kind of made us feel a little better about that and, you know, about what we did as a group. There's nothing that could have prevented this. And the house also did not have working smoke detectors. So that plus the hoarding conditions made it,
listen, you know, that, virtually, boys and girls. Smoke detectors.
They do save lives.
I
know it's irritating as hell when you're trying to cook, you know, a freaking roast chicken and it, or a tri-tip, and it gets a little burned and it goes off, but you won't be freaking mad when your house catches fire. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't want to say, you know, if they had them, they would have been, you know, saved, but it definitely would have gave them a warning that something was wrong.
Well, here's the deal. Is there something they could have done that possibly would have saved their own lives? The answer to that is yes. They could have had working smoke detectors. Would they be alive? Don't know. Could it have made a difference? It absolutely could have.
Also hoarding. I mean,
oh yeah, there's that too.
Houses that catch fire in hoarding conditions, those houses burn so hot, so fast, it's hard to even get in. I mean, I've seen firefighters venting roofs on small, like, single family residents, one story, and I'm telling you, those flames shoot so high out of that roof. It is so hot in there, you can feel it like three houses away, just the heat coming off of there. I mean they could have not hoarded, they could have maintained their smoke detectors, but at the end of it, I mean, that's rough, you know.
So now, was that just a tactical debrief? Or was that a full, like, did they Because, Mike, I'm curious to know how, when, you know, like I said, you're a pretty young guy. They all know your age. They all know you're fresh out of the fire academy. You know, this is a tough thing for any firefighter to handle, let alone somebody so young. So was it just a tactical debrief, or did anybody actually come talk to you about how you were doing?
It was a little bit of both. All of them are, I don't want to say they're licensed or anything, but they've all had their own experiences. I believe they're all volunteers. They just come in and help support, you know, what happened. Now, they don't know what happened at the fire. So that's, you know, what the briefing is kind of, you know, we tell them what happened. They ask us, yeah, hey, what did you do? What did you do? You know, and they kind of build their own case. And, you know, from that, they gain that there was nothing better we could have done. And then, you know, they had all our phone numbers and everything. So they had called us a few days later just to check in, you know, see how we're doing and everything. You know, if we need to reach out, you know, we can reach out if we need to. So that was, it definitely helped. But to kind of back up a little bit, when I went home, I live, it's just me and my girlfriend. You know, I hadn't really been affected too much as far as I was aware. I came home and I kind of woke her up because it was, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't too terribly late. You know, and I just kind of had like a sad look on my face, and she had asked, is everything okay? And I couldn't even get words out. I just broke into tears. You know,
yeah,
after seeing everything that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and especially when you finally, you don't think it's a problem, and then you get near somebody you care about who you feel safe with and who you feel like an emotional bond with. And then, you know, all of a sudden shit gets real, real quick.
Yeah. So, you know, I talked to her a little bit about it once I compiled myself, you know, went to the briefing, did all that. And just kind of as, you know, the week progressed, it got a little easier to kind of, you know that nothing I could have done would change anything, and just kind of, you know, keep on moving on, you know, don't let it, you know, get me down, and just, you know, keep doing what I need to do to stick with it. You know, I shouldn't let this event keep me from, you know, supporting my community the way that I have.
Right. So you're a younger firefighter. Do you have any advice for other firefighters in your position that are similar time on and things like that? Maybe they're going to their first hot call or first bad call that ends up, you know, bad.
Pretty much just, you know, stick with it. You're going to have those calls. Obviously, if it's not for you, you know, don't burden yourself with it. But, you know, if you can do it, you know, it makes the world to someone's day, you know, knowing that they have someone there that's by their side trying to help them out.
Yeah, that was going to be another question I had, is if this had changed your opinion about doing this full time. Because obviously, if you do this as a volunteer or part-time or reserve or in any capacity where you have a regular full-time day job, you're going to be exposed to it, but not with the repetition and frequency that you would be if you were doing it full-time. So were you ever looking at pursuing this full-time, or did this change your mind at all? How did it affect your ideas about this as a career?
When I was younger, you know, I always wanted to be a firefighter and never thought that I would be physically capable of doing it. I'm kind of a, you know, smaller person, not very strong, but, you know, had the heart in it. So, you know, I finally got involved with, you know, with the fire company in the area and kind of saw how they ran and everything, and thought it was, you know, hey, this is something I can actually do. But with my passion of construction, you know, I can do that full time and then do, you know, firefighting part time. Whereas, you know, the opposite is not exactly, you know, true or easy to do.
Oh, so, I can tell you right now, all the LA firefighters, that is their second job. They all have side businesses making furniture or cabinetry or plumbing, or it doesn't seem like they string 9 or 10 days on together to, and then they take like 3 weeks off to work on whatever side job they have. At least that's the way it is down south.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's impossible, but, you know, definitely with everything how it is, it's just a lot easier just to volunteer and do that. Plus that way,
man, he just said volunteering is easier. Experiencing that kind of crap for free does not sound easier to me.
It definitely takes a lot to, you know, to go out on these calls and know that, you know, you might have to see some things you don't want to see, or, you know, you might not come home at the end of the day. Right. That's always a worry for me, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, I'm helping some innocent person that doesn't deserve it. So, you know, I try to step in and do my part.
That's great. I mean, for free, I don't think anyone can ask any more of you. I mean, you think you're doing a really good job. I mean, that's intense. You're doing this for free and you could not come home.
But yep. Then again, you know, I mean, you do get to ride on the big red truck and play with the big water cannon and use an axe on somebody's shit and tear a car apart with the jaws of life. There are some fun parts of being a firefighter. It's just, you know,
all the they joke around when I'm at work, you know, okay, we're going to take these windows out. You know, don't firefighter your way through it. You know, we got to take it out the right way, break the glass. So, you know,
or as I like to call them, evidence destruction technicians.
Yeah, we're pretty good at that. Yeah, we love our destruction.
Yes, you do. You guys will tear it apart. No chill when it comes to tearing shit up. Love it. So, also because we can't do it.
So we did figure out the cause of the fire. I was actually in there with the investigators, and they kind of narrowed it down to the refrigerator kind of malfunction. You know, electrical fire came up the cord and then caught the wall on fire behind it. So, you know, it was nothing, no arson, nothing like that. It was just completely an electrical issue that just, you know, started a fire.
Wow. Do you think so just
completely random, shitty, freaking circumstances, nothing malicious or not even negligence, it sounds like then, no?
No, nothing with, like, you know, tension cords or anything, just a regular fridge plugged into the wall.
Now, do you think because they were had a hoarding situation going on, when that caught fire, do you think instead of running out, you know, they weren't able to because it was so hoarded and it caught on fire so quickly?
Their path outside would not have been, you know, hindered by their stuff. The stairway was pretty clear. The hallway upstairs was pretty clear. It was mainly some parts of downstairs and, you know, mostly upstairs was just filled with stuff. They also could have been trying to get out that window that the air conditioner was in. You know, maybe that's why they were laying on the ground the way they were. You know, we'll never know what happened in that room, but, you know, they definitely could have gotten out. I mean,
we
can make assumptions
and we figured out, you know, at some point dad was protecting the kid, but yeah, at what point that is, we don't know, right?
Yeah. At the stage that they had discovered the fire, it was not anything they would have been able to escape going through the house. They would have had to catch it pretty early on to do that.
Wow.
So at the point at which they discovered it, they were already in need of rescue.
Yeah, there was no way they were, you know, the mother had opened the door and immediately collapsed. You know, there was no way. The best thing they could have done was just keep that door closed, and that would have bought them a little bit of time. You know, but at that point, there's nothing they could do. The neighbors had actually flagged down the police who were in the area and said that their neighbor's house was on fire. So that's how it kind of, you know, became the call. You know, they didn't call, nothing like that. So it just happened to be someone looking out their window and seeing the fire.
Wow. I mean, if only it had been a little bit sooner. But again, if the fire department does everything right and still nobody reports it on time, and even if you had been there, you know, and known where they were, it still could have been too late. At some point you realize there's just sometimes nothing you can do.
Absolutely. And the way our department kind of runs is, I don't want to say that it's not structured in any way, because it is, but it's a very, you know, push hard. We get in there, we put the fire out. You know, we don't sit at the door for 5 minutes trying to, you know, get our stuff together. You know, we're in the front door immediately and, you know, we're getting to work. You know, we hit it hard and we get, you know, get shit done. So.
Wow. I mean, you can't ask for any more than that. I mean,
And you're how old?
I'm 22.
Yeah. I was still freaking playing guitar in nightclubs when I was 22. I wouldn't have been mature enough to handle being a firefighter, let alone a cop. Ooh.
Yeah, I tell the dudes all the time, like, I see them come on, they're like, I came on at 20 and a half. I'm like, fuck, dude, at 20 and a half, I couldn't even fathom becoming a cop at 20 and a half, going through the academy, and on when I was appointed, be 21, and then have to tell some, 40-year-old or 50-year-old or even a 30-year-old, hey, this is what you have to do, and try to take them to jail. I'd be like, oh, fuck. That's crazy. You're so young and you're doing this. It's great. Wow. Now, do you see yourself doing this for the long term as a reserve?
Oh, absolutely. Anywhere that I go, I will, attempt to stick with it in some way, shape, or form. Even if it comes to, when I'm older, where I'm not able to physically do it anymore, still be involved in some kind of social, member or something, help with fundraising, because really our department does not have a lot of money to play around with. We're kind of one of the lower ends of the area. So any type of fundraising that I can help with, or, recruitment, whatever, I'd be happy to do that at least.
Okay. That's good. Wow.
It is more of a brotherhood. I hear about you guys talking with the police, you don't get the kind of support that we do. I've had multiple people reach out to me, since then, making sure that I was okay, and that everything's good there.
I think some of that's also small town. I think that small towns are a lot better about it than large agencies, because you have personal relationships with people as opposed to a massive 9 or 10,000 person army where you're just a number.
Yeah. And they don't want to see, something like this, make them lose members. They want to be there and help out whatever way they can to, make sure there's people there to continue to answer that call.
Right. Now, they need their volunteer fire department, so they can't burn you guys out.
Yeah.
Now, do you guys get a lot of calls, or is it kind of a small town atmosphere where you get maybe one structure fire a month or two structure fires a month? Is it pretty consistent, pretty busy?
Fire-wise, it kind of varies. Since I've joined, we've had kind of some low numbers. So far this year has actually been the highest with, I believe, 13 working fires so far.
Okay, so it's not a whole lot of fires.
No, my company gets probably about 500 a year. The department gets about 1,000. So it's okay. Some big numbers, but most of them are fire alarms and stuff like that. So
yeah, those are calls for service, not actual fires.
Yeah, actual fires, in the past 3 years that I've kind of been there, it's roughly, 10 a year is the average. So, you take out the time that I'm at work, I maybe make 5 of those.
Right. Then you get a city or county like LA and you're talking 10 a week.
Yeah.
Or more. Yeah.
Now, have you had any crazy extractions or saves or anything like that?
I personally have not. Mainly the calls that I go on are, fires and rescues. Typically the fire alarms at our usual places, apartment buildings. I don't typically go to unless I'm in the area, just because, I know the career guys can handle that. It's just someone cooking. Obviously, if it turns into a fire, I'll be there. I try to get out as much as I can, but I personally have not had any like big saves or, rescues or anything like that, I've been like the guy for.
Hmm. So when you're doing the reserve stuff, you bring your own vehicle to, this active working fire, the fire scene. Do you ever get a chance to like maybe do a full shift where you're actually in the house and then you hop on the truck whenever they need it? Or is it strictly, hey, if you hear it over the radio, it's good, come to it? Or how does that work?
So we're allowed to go to any call inside of, the limits of the town area. Personal vehicles, there's no restrictions on that. We always have someone on. So, it's a 24-hour shift, 24, 48. We have a rotation of the three career staff guys for our station. You know, I can go to the station, hang out as much or as little as I want. You know, I can sleep there, you know, pretty much anytime. You know, I can hang out for an hour, you know, stay the night and just run calls that way. And okay. In that case, you know, we go
so it's
to
pretty much up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I can hang out at the station, you know, and get calls that way, or I can just drive to them myself. You know, when you're at the station, you go to every call, but when you're driving from home, you know, you don't go to every call because you know there's people that are going to be there.
Can you imagine, Chuck, be like, I'm bored and I got nothing to do. I'm going to go ride the big red truck tonight.
Right.
And then be like, oh, it's 3 a.m. I can't sleep. I'm going to go back home and sleep in my own bed.
I can do that. Yep.
Oh, wow.
That's like the, other than not getting paid, he's got the gig, man.
It's definitely a rush, you know, getting waken up in the middle of the night while I'm at the station, you know, to go hop on the truck and go somewhere.
Is it like some euphoric feeling where you're like, oh, I don't know what's going on, but I know I got to get my stuff.
Pretty much. Definitely. Like when I first started, that's what it was like. You know, my first call, I didn't even hear what it was. I just got on the truck
because I got toned out and you're like, we're going.
Yeah. It turned out to be a building fire. You know, it ended up being nothing, but, you know, it was a heater malfunction, but I didn't hear what it was. All I knew was if I don't get on the truck fast enough, they're going to leave without me. So that's all I was focused on. And, you know, as I have more time on, you know, I start to, you know, pay attention to more things. You know, I listen to the radio, hear what's going on, you know, try to hear the notes and, you know, get ready, you know what I'm going into.
I've always thought it'd be fun to try and ride in a fire truck going code 3, but especially on with the tillerman on the, you know, when the trucks have the tiller and just kind of, I don't necessarily want to drive the tiller. I just want to like be in it and feel what being on the tiller is like and how that, you know, how that is. That'd be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have one of those, unfortunately, in our town.
But you probably don't have a building big enough to require a ladder truck with a tiller, I'll bet.
We have a couple. We have a couple. Oh, really? That are probably about 10 stories. Yeah.
Well, then you go and write that grant, Ryan, and get your department a tiller truck and be the hero.
We got the neighboring departments that bring their tower trucks and everything. Unfortunately. So
maybe one of those guys will let you ride on the tiller one time.
I've gone up in the buckets a couple of times, but I've never driven, you know, to a call with them.
So, you know, when I've been on the job for about like, you know, 10 years, and every time I see firefighters rolling to an active working fire, they're so happy and they're like so energetic, but then I know, see them rolling to some BS call and they're like, but like you can see the excitement in their face and just the pure adrenaline that's pumping through and they're like, oh, heck yeah. And at the same token, you also see them when they get there and it's nothing in their life.
Well, you know what, though? I equate it to like when you get sent to a vehicle burg or a cold resburg call or, you know, just some stupid chicken shit call. And you're like, this is stupid. Those are the things we have to do. But I am never pissed off when I'm rolling code 3, chasing a bad guy or about to get into a fight or something like that. That is, you know, that's like, that's the fun part, you know? So I can understand if a firefighter's like, I do not want to go to another grandma who fell and can't get out of the fucking bathroom. But if grandma's house is on fire and I got to drag her out of the bathroom with an SCBA on, then I'm in.
Yeah. It's what we train for. You know, we don't wish harm on anybody, but if there's a fire, we want to be there and we want to be the hero.
Yeah, firefighters and fires, I imagine, and cops and pursuits are like a lab with a tennis ball, right? That's the level of happiness.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Unless you're the first unit in a pursuit, then you're like, man, I got to write this report.
Well, there's that. Being second unit in the pursuit. Being second in the pursuit is the best. Like, I'll take second.
Absolutely. You're like, I'll call the streets. I'll keep going.
No problem. I'll follow you. I'll call the streets, brother. And when we get there, I'll help you take the guy into custody. And then we're done. I'll do nothing else.
Yeah, in second, you're always like, hey, primary, hold the car. If they stop and bail, we'll go after him. And they're like, oh, come on, man.
Oh, and also don't put my name in the report. Because I don't want to go to court. No. Ryan, I appreciate you coming on, especially talking about volunteer firefighting, because it's one of those. I mean, there are reserve police officers and stuff like that, but as I said, I wouldn't be a volunteer cop for nothing, not at all, like at all. You know, I might go volunteer at a police department to help them with something, but I would not be do volunteer police work. So volunteer firefighting, man, that's doing the Lord's work. And because of that, as our listeners know, we try to dedicate every episode to a firefighter who's killed in the line of duty. So in honor of our friend Ryan, the volunteer firefighter, I wanted to honor New Bern, North Carolina, township number, company number 7, fire rescue volunteer firefighter Ralph de Blasi. He was 62 years old, and he was responding to a vehicle collision when he was killed in a vehicle collision. So, I mean, talk about terrible circumstances. This guy's volunteer firefighter, 62 years old, responding to a traffic collision, and actually is involved in a fatal traffic collision. So rest easy, brother. We've got it from here. It's terrible to lose a firefighter, but it's even worse when it's so senseless and just a traffic collision responding to another traffic collision. And he's a volunteer. So our hearts go out to his family.
Yeah, that's rough. That's really sad, man. Did you have anybody, Ryan, that you would want to, I think we spoke earlier. Did you say you had someone?
Yeah, I do. It's a, not our department, but, you know, about 20 minutes down the road. They had a structure fire go out on the 4th of July this year. And firefighter Sean DeMunk was on the third floor and called out for a mayday. And he was found unresponsive. They took him to the hospital and he was pronounced there. He was 35 years old. And him and his wife were Canadian, and they had just been here a little over 2 years, and they were actually planning to move back home to be with their family on July 6th. So 2 days before they were supposed to move home, he was unfortunately killed in the line of duty.
Well, man, well, it's rough. Rest easy, brother. We got it from here. Those are both rough, man.
I'm sorry.
Ugh, it's just, man, why is it? It's like always right before you move, right before you retire, right? Like, man, it's like you got to work. You never plan to retire or it's going to kill you. Or if you do plan to retire or move, like, keep your head down, man. Just freaking lay low.
They had a picnic for the 4th of July and kind of a going away party, you know, that day. So for him to respond to one last call, you know, was... I know right now they're still having people cover their firehouse, you know, as they kind of deal with this.
Right. I mean, and that affects actually, everybody.
He had about 2 years on, so about the same time I did. And he had actually graduated the academy, the class after mine. So he was, you know, very fresh and planned on actually moving up to Canada and joining a fire company up there and getting, you know, taken by a department.
Man, it's when it's one of your contemporaries too, like you, that makes it real, because if it can happen to him, it can happen to you.
Absolutely. And with it being so close, you know, it's only a couple minutes down the road, you know, it's not too far. So.
Wow. Well, Jesus. Ryan, we appreciate you coming on and thank you for serving your community. That's awesome that you, you're willing to step up and do that. I mean, I'm sure you'll make more money in construction, so that'll be awesome. But it's still good of you to be willing to step up and say, you know what, it's actually going to cost you stuff. It may not cost you money. I mean, obviously it's going to cost you gas money and stuff like that, but there's an emotional toll and there's a cost to your family and there's a cost to your time. And so if you really think about it, Ryan is actually paying a personal cost to help his community, but let's hope that the years of service in your community will pay you back at the end. Let's just hope that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And thank you guys for having me on. This was a really good experience.
We appreciate it, man. Chuck, do you have anything?
Yeah. Make sure your smoke detectors work. Clean your chimneys.
No shit.
Don't hoard stuff. I mean, it's
fire season.
Like jokingly, but no, seriously, guys. Like, I want to try to leave you guys with tidbits of information. I know everyone on the show does. I mean, but make sure you have working smoke detectors. I know it goes off in the middle of the night because the batteries are dead, but a lot of those are linked to some sort of response. So if they go off, your local fire station will get the notification, and you might be asleep. You might be a hard sleeper. You may not hear it, but that thing may save your life. So make sure those batteries are, you know, up to date, go around, you know, every 6 months or so, do a test, make sure they're properly functioning and working.
And, yeah, and when they chirp at you to tell you that the battery's low, don't just disconnect them. Actually chase the fucking battery. And actually, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you. I know I'm not talking to, well, I guess I am talking to Chuck. I'm talking to you, listener. There's at least three people right now who are listening going, fuck, I need to go get some 9-volt batteries right now. Cause I know where my smoke detector is sitting with no battery in it. Cause it started chirping at 2:15 in the morning. And I just wanted to go back to bed. So I got the broom out and I smacked it until the battery popped out. And now it's been 6 months and I haven't put a battery back in. I'm talking to you three listeners, go get the fucking battery and go put it back in.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, I talked to a buddy of mine and this is big. I don't care if you have a gas fireplace or a wood burning one. If it has a chimney or a flute, you need to make sure before it gets cold out, you have a one of those chimney sweep guys come and just make sure it's clean, because the soot buildup, even from a gas, there's still carcinogens burning. It can build up and eventually catch on fire. Next thing you know, your house is on fire. I mean, just ask Rachel Ray.
Yeah, chimney fires are no joke either.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just a chimney fire, but most firefighters will tell you it'll go from chimney fire to structure fire real quick.
Yeah, and also, if you guys want
to listen to the two cops giving fire advice, woohoo!
Right? I mean, hey, I'm basically an honorary firefighter. I've been in a house or apartment when it was set on fire with me inside of it. That shit was
out of fire with a garden hose.
I put out a campfire with a hose.
There you go. On duty. Firefighters are like, hey, thanks for the help.
Yeah,
don't put it all out before we get there.
we put out a fire with one of those fire extinguishers. Man.
Yeah.
But anyway. If you guys want to come on the show, it's booking.warstories@gmail. We also have the Instagram, you know, warstories official. Go there, DM. If you want to come on, email, I will get the email and I will be talking to you. I'll probably tell you to call me because it becomes easier that way. Instead of looking back through like 10, 15 threads on the email, I'll probably just end up giving you a call before we go on to go over everything. But hey, booking.warstories@gmail, that's the email. And then we have the Instagram, Facebook. Reach out to us there. We'll give you the email, that way you can get in contact with me and then I'll book you. So don't be afraid to
get
reach
it.
Out.
Book him.
Yeah. And if you have any cool photos like Ryan here has that he should be sending us of him venting a roof.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's pretty awesome.
We'll post that on social media with the captions. So send us a picture of your newspaper, bro. We'll put it on our Instagram.
If you have any photos of you guys being heroes, we want them. We would love to show the world.
Also, send us photos of you being heroes repping the War Stories brand with patches and decals and shit like that.
Yeah. And plenty more will be, I'm telling you. I'm
going to
be
gonna hit it hard this whole year, thing. Baby.
Like, we're going to have a good amount of stuff. It may come off. It may sell out pretty quick, but the faster it sells out,
so does Supreme.
have low numbers, but being released. But we want to make sure that you guys like the stuff that we're coming out with. So, buy it and then, you know, we'll come out with more. We'll just renew the orders. If you guys really like it, let us know on social media by tagging us and letting us know that you like it, rep it. We'll get more of it. And if you guys have ideas, don't be afraid to shoot them off. I mean, we're working on another design right now. Once the next two get released, then we'll have another one coming out. And then if you guys have any designs that you want to see input, let us know.
Well, and I think on that note, Chuck, you can email either one of us. You can leave us a voicemail. We're going to be doing some changes to the website. We're going to put the guys from the locker room up there, and we're going to create a section in our briefing room for just locker room stuff where we can share memes and you can hopefully interact with Marco and Matt as well. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.